Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up on your radio today, Dutch composer Jacob TV talks about the outspoken views and crazy over-the-top music that have earned him a big following in Europe, and a review of the best CD versions of Wagner's Tristan und Isolde. But first, internet radio. It was once a lonely frontier for fans of obscure music. Now, though, it's pretty crowded. Between 50 million and 70 million Americans listen to web radio every month, and about 20% of 18 to 34-year-olds tune into the web every week. One site, live365.com, is home to literally thousands of webcasts. But webcasters say that a federally mandated increase in the royalties that they pay to the recording industry now threatens their livelihood. We'll start with John Simpson from Sound Exchange. That's the organization that collects these webcasting royalties for the recording industry. John, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So terrestrial radio doesn't pay this particular type of royalty that we're talking about, the sound recording copyright to the companies, record companies themselves. Why do webcasters pay it, and why the need to increase the amount that they pay?
Let's break that down. First, you're right that over-the-air radio or terrestrial radio doesn't pay these fees, and frankly, it's just a historical anomaly. They should be paying these fees. For many years, you know, they basically said, well, we're promoting the sale of your records every time we play one of your songs. But we know that, you know, a vast majority of the audience listening to radio, it's a passive audience. They don't go out and run out and buy everything they hear. So they should be paying for the music they use. And again, it's just that in 1909, the Copyright Act got passed that had a performance right for songwriters. We didn't have a recording industry yet. The recording industry grew up in the 20s and 30s, and the Copyright Act was not updated until 1976.
So it's kind of a fluke of history then, and the record industry wants to make sure that that sort of thing doesn't happen again.
Correct. And in fact, if you look, you know, of the 30 major free market democratic countries around the world, of those 30, 29 pay performers for performances on the radio, and one doesn't, and that's the United States.
Well, but we do pay the publishing copyright. You know, I mean, it's not like no one's getting paid when something's played on over-the-air radio.
Correct, but the songwriter gets paid.
Right, just not the record company.
Don't. So, you know, you hear the Temptations singing one of those great tracks, and the songwriter was getting paid, but the band wasn't. And, you know, you hear those songs over and over again. Aretha Franklin singing Respect, she's not getting paid. Otis Redding is, because he wrote it.
Okay. So the webcasters are paying this fee.
They do pay both sides of the copyright.
Okay.
That's right.
So why there's this new ruling that came out in March is a fairly substantial increase in the amount that they're paying. Why that?
The process, if you will, there was a rate set in 2002 by a panel of arbitrators, three arbitrators. And those rates took effect from 1998 to 2002. Both sides essentially agreed to push them forward. By the time we finished the proceeding, it was time to start again. And I think both sides just said, look, let's not do this right away. Push the rates forward 2003 and 2004, and then again push them forward to 2005 when this new proceeding took place. In the interim, the webcasters who didn't like the arbitration process went to Congress and got a new process. It was called CARP reform, and we got three copyright royalty judges. It did make the process more open in that under the old rules, you had to pay a piece of the arbitrator's fees. And so for a smaller service, you know, not knowing what those fees might be, it might have been intimidating to participate. Now the judges were being paid by the government. And essentially all you had to pay for was your own case. So it made it a little bit more accessible.
So you're saying that this was a more transparent process?
In some ways.
Okay. Because I'm not sure I'm following it at all. We're speaking with John Simpson from Sound Exchange. This is the organization that collects webcasting royalties on behalf of the recording industry. I also want to bring Jonathan Potter into the discussion. He's from Digital Media Association, a trade organization that represents the major webcasters. Jonathan, John's discussion of why webcasters pay this royalty, it seems, fair and reasonable. What's the problem that the DMA, the Digital Music Digital Media Association, has with the rate increase?
The problem with the rate increase is its magnitude. The problem with the rate increase for small webcasters is it takes them from paying 10-12% of their revenue to paying 300% of their revenue. Therefore, it puts them out of business. The problem for large webcasters is it takes them from paying an average of 25-30% of their revenue, which is already four times what XM and Sirius pay for this same royalty, and obviously well over what broadcast pays, because broadcast pays zero.
Right.
It takes the large webcasters from 25-30% of their revenue for these royalties to 50-60% of the revenue or more, or if you include the per station minimum, it's just mega millions of dollars, for many stations for many services that offer literally hundreds of thousands of stations.
So you're not arguing about paying the royalty or even about perhaps paying a little bit more. You're arguing about paying a lot more.
Well, we are not arguing about paying the royalty. We are arguing about the amount. And I noticed, my friend John Simpson, whom I respect a great deal and I enjoy spending time with, deftly answered your question about what was the justification for the new royalty with an answer about the process that led to the new royalty. The short answer is there is no justification for the royalty increase. There is no justification for taking the radio services that have the least amount of revenue and that pay royalties, having them pay the most amount of royalties and putting them and making them bankrupt. That doesn't help artists. It doesn't help record labels.
All right. Well, John Simpson, is Jonathan Potter right? I mean, the idea of charging a small company 300% of its revenue obviously is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, John points out a problem. There are 49 services who are known as the SWISAs, or the Small Webcaster Settlement Act companies. There were 49 of them in 2006. These companies are typically, smaller. They got special legislation from Congress in 2003 because they couldn't pay, even at the old CARP rate, the per stream on a per stream basis. And I think they were given a percentage of revenue option rather than a per stream option. So a service would be paying, let's say, a 10% of their revenue or 12%, escalating as they earn more money. This was a sort of policy decision. Congress said, look, this may not be a free market or a rate, but we want these smaller webcasters to have a stake in this game, and they passed this legislation for 3 years. And again, those small webcasters paid in 2006 at those percentage of revenue rates. And John is right that that group of services switching to a per stream rate will be in trouble. And we're certainly looking into it. We've certainly engaged in discussions, or just started to engage in discussions with representatives of those small webcasters.
Okay, so a deal had been cut with 49 of these small webcasters some years ago, and there is a possibility of more deals being cut even in the face of the new regulations.
I think, though, that it's important to note that, they use a lot of music and have not been able to monetize it very well, and I think there's some very interesting data about it, and it really does raise some interesting issues about the kinds of licenses when you have a statutory license that's imposed by the government. This is a license where the government says, for this price, you have to give your music to a service. They get to use it however they want. There are some restrictions that Jonathan would be happy to point out. But essentially, you get to use the Beatles, you get to use, Aretha, whoever, Arcade Fire, any number of groups in any kind of genre. There's no restriction. You can't say no. And so you've got to be very careful when you set that license. Mm-hmm. People can always negotiate other terms. So, for example, a new artist coming up could always say, gee, I like this particular station. I'm willing to give them my music at half the statutory rate or at a quarter of the rate or for free. It's their choice.
But is it the band's? Does the band have the ability to say that, or does their record company need to say that that's okay too?
Well, if the band has to own their masters to be able, because
well,
it is
a very rare thing.
Issue. Yeah. Well, for independent artists, it's not so rare, and even for some major label acts, it's a growing trend that they own their masters.
All right. Well, let's give people a chance to hear a little bit of what we're talking about. The American Music Center here in New York has a webcast that they call Counterstream Radio, which this morning featured this music from a band called Tin Hat. Now, there aren't too many places where you would hear the band Tin Hat on terrestrial radio. This actually happens to be one of them here on Soundcheck because they've played here in our studio. But this morning they were on the webcast stream of the American Music Center called Counterstream Radio. And we're talking about the future of webcasting, which according to a lot of webcasters is threatened by the large rise in royalty payments that they will now be expected to come up with. And we've been speaking with John Simpson from Sound Exchange, which collects those royalties for the recording industry, and with Jonathan Potter of the Digital Media Association, a trade group that represents the major webcasters. Jonathan, let me ask you, I think I can guess what the answer to this question is from what John was just saying before. Are all webcasters created equal?
I think the answer is no, they are not created equal, but arguably all songs are not created equal either. The CRB imposing a per-song royalty suggests that your 9-minute Grateful Dead song has the same value as your 90-second Ramones song. Now, I'm not sure which one is worth more. I can tell you which one you can sell more ads around. And so, in fact, the per-song streamed metric, I think in almost every case is ludicrous as compared to either a percentage of revenue metric or an hourly, a music stream per hour metric, which is, you know, on an hourly basis you can figure out how many ads you sell, you can figure out what your revenue is. Nobody measures revenue or audience on a per song basis. Except obviously the Copyright Royalty Board.
Now, are any of these webcasters making money from the smallest, even to AOL and Yahoo? Do they turn a profit with their web streams?
I think the answer is today some of them do. Some of them have figured out a way to shoehorn a fair amount of music, a fair amount of audience into a small entity, and there are some who can make what you and I would call a profit. Whether they've repaid investors or whether they actually take home very much money is hard to say. But, you know, if you're a small webcaster who's figured out a way to sell some ads, you know, perhaps you can make a profit. There are very, very, very few of those. And all of these people are counting on the fact that the advertising world is moving more and more into the Internet realm. The folks who are selling Internet radio ads that are like traditional radio ads are beginning to gain some traction in the marketplace, but they're not at a place where they can afford 300% to 1,200% increases in their royalties, where the royalties are now by far the number one largest cost, higher than programming, higher than human capital, higher than bandwidth, and frankly, it's just a brick wall.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we had artists in, we have some artists who are going to be in Congress tomorrow talking about how the idea of direct licensing to webcasters is theoretically attractive, but as a practical matter, a fantasy. You know, a small independent artist is not picking up the phone, calling all the webcasters they can and saying, play my music. They're emailing it to the webcasters. They're enjoying it. They're understanding that their transaction costs need to be saved for booking gigs and selling CDs and pushing their music, not, you know, putting up form licenses and trying to make sure that everybody understands that their music is free. You know, in fact, they do appreciate the small amount of royalties they get from SoundExchange, and we don't mind paying royalties. But the idea that you're going to pay 300% of your revenue, or frankly even 60% of your revenue or 40% of your revenue, when our competitors pay zero or pay 7%,
7% being the rate for satellite radio.
Right.
Now, when you mentioned having some artists on Capitol Hill, that's for the Internet Radio Equality Act, which the Representatives Jay Inslee, Democrat from Washington, and Don Mazzullo, Republican from Illinois, proposed last week. I know that's sort of working its way through, but unfortunately we don't have a lot of time to talk about that. So let me, John Simpson, come back to you and just ask you, is there a danger here? Jonathan talks about, you know, raising the royalty rate by 300 to 1,200%. Is there a danger of killing the goose that, if it hasn't laid a golden egg yet, at least has the potential to do so somewhere down the road?
I've certainly said this often enough, and Jonathan and I talk about this frequently. You know, we certainly don't want to see internet radio go away. For one thing, they pay us. For another, they provide really much. You know, more quality listening experience than terrestrial radio. So, you know, we're certainly going to sit down and have long conversations with John, with other, you know, people in the marketplace to make sure that we do have a healthy internet radio community. You know, one thing I want to point out, I mean, Jonathan was pointing out the advertising marketplace, but, you know, one place where we've certainly seen profitability is, you know, if someone's willing to charge or to pay $2.99 a month, which is quite cheap when you think satellite radio is $12.99 a month, you know, the typical royalty bill from us for the average listener to a subscription service is about 66 cents a month.
So there are models where this might work then.
Correct.
All right. Well, we'll need to leave it there. Obviously, the situation very much in flux with the Internet Radio Equality Act now before Congress. We've been speaking with John Simpson from SoundExchange. They collect the webcasting royalties on behalf of the recording industry. And Jonathan Potter from the trade group Digital Media Association, representing the major webcasters. John and John, I'm going to see if I can find somebody not named John to talk to in the next part of the program. But thanks to the two of you for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And in the background, we'll actually hear a little bit of WNYC's own webcast stream, WNYC2. And actually a 20-year-old edition of WNYC's New Sounds program with music, again, that you don't hear anywhere else. Randall Myers is the composer. In a moment, Jacob ter Veldhuis, a Dutch composer whose works combine rock and chamber music plus the occasional boombox, will join us. And then later, the self-described opera queen tells us about his favorite recordings of Wagner's Tristan und Isolde. This is Soundcheck.